Well, welcome to the February 12th, 2018 meeting of the Senate Committee on Business and Transportations. We have two bills, actually, that we're working today, and I will tell you that the bill that we are working on the Energy Commission is Senate Bill 1519, but if you want to comment under 1537, I will open them together. Senate Bill 1564 is the other bill that we actually said that wrong. Actually, that's the only ones we have. We don't have the distillery. Yeah, we do. Mm-hmm. 1564 is the distillery bill. Excuse me. In all cases, the bills are waiting for fiscal reports, so we can't move them today. So we will just be hearing them, and then we'll be carrying them over until Wednesday. So we will start out with opening a public hearing on Senate Bill 1519 and Senate Bill 1537.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we first heard Senate Bill 1519 on the 5th last Monday. Since that time, we have received the Dash 1 amendment. The Dash 1 amendment updates language of the state energy policy, and it modifies the makeup of the Oregon Energy Commission and reduces the number of voting members in the original bill from 7 to 6 and increases the number of non-voting members from 2 to 4. It changes the statewide strategic energy report to a statewide strategic energy plan, and it specifies that the plan and any subsequent revisions must be submitted to the Legislative Assembly at the beginning of the next odd-numbered year regular session. It may not go into effect until on or after January 1 following the close of that session, unless earlier permission is granted. And it changes to 0.15% the percentage of the energy resource supplier's gross operating revenue that the annual energy resource supplier assessment may not exceed. We have not received the fiscal impact statement on it. We do have the revenue impact statement, and it is posted at this time on OLIS.
Okay. And I've got a number of people signed up on these two bills, and we'll start off with Irene Gilbert. Is Irene? There she is. Good afternoon, Irene.
Hello. Anyone else? Am I here by myself today?
Okay. Well, to start with,
are. Irene Gilbert, 2310 Adams Avenue, La Grande, Oregon. I have testified on this bill before. I support both of the bills, either of the bills. Although, as you know, I didn't realize till the end of my testimony last time that the Energy Facility Siting Council rules were not also part of this package. So I'm going to focus on the need for an amendment to include that particular group. And I provided you some examples of the kinds of things that are occurring with the Energy Facility Siting Council and the Energy Siting Department of the, or Division of the Department of Energy. I am very concerned about their lack of actual activity that actually gives the public any kind of voice in their decision making. As you know, there's a lawsuit of I believe it's 9 different environmental groups. The last amendment rules that they promulgated basically eliminate the public from decision making. And if there's any part of the department that needs to be included in this bill, it's that particular section. And I can examples for those of you who are not aware, I gave 10 examples of contested case requests on the Summit Ridge wind development. This wind development would put turbines within a mile of the Wild and Scenic Deschutes, where you will, if you're floating the river, you'll be able to look up and see wind turbines up above you. They approved a 90 decibel noise limit. If any of you are real familiar with sound noise, 90 decibels is a lot. It's like an airplane taking off. And the way they do these things is they, while the legislature believes you have yes-no decisions, there are not yes-no. That's an objective thing. They make these decisions subjective because at the end of virtually everyone, they say it's no significant impact. So there's no significant impact for the views. There's no significant impact for noise. And in 7 years of following this group, I was charged 7 years ago to get through a contested case on an amendment to report back and to help the people and the friends of the Grand Ronde Valley understand how to get through this process. I've never been approved. I'm not a dumb person. but I have never been able to get a contested case heard by that department on any amendment ever. And I'm not the only one. They claim that there was one that went through on a, not a wind development, but they just plain, because they have control over the rules, they have control over the decisions, they have control over the contested case decisions, they block you at every single stance. And I mean, I've been denied over things like the studies that I referenced from Starkey Experimental Station regarding elk weren't applicable to things on the in the Columbia Basin because it wasn't exactly the same kind of area as where those studies occurred. I mean, those are studies that are accepted everywhere except with the Department of Energy. So I guess I would like to just like to challenge you because right now there is a request as an amendment to add over 13,000 acres to an existing 33,000 acre wind development. Now, they're doing this as an amendment. It's a Montague wind development. They are saying that this extra 13,000 acres may be placed, they may be placing wind turbines there. They may be placing up to 620 acres of solar panels there. They may be placing 100 megawatts of battery storage. They may be placing some kind of a combination. The statute does not support adding land to a development, let alone adding a whole different kind of energy generation method. And how does the public in their 30 days figure out the difference between the impacts of if they put solar, how does that compare to if they put wind turbines, where are they going to put them? So I would be willing to write a contested, some comments and a contested case for any of you to submit. And I have a really strong feeling that you'll be denied, just like I am denied, but I'd love to have you experience how it is that they manipulate the rules. I have had on the record an individual on the Energy Facility Siting Council say that once they promulgate rules, they trump the statute. FSAC rules, Department of Energy rules, have more authority, according to the Department of Energy, than the statutes. And that's why they're thinking that they can do this kind of thing. The statutes are clear. At any rate, it just appears to me that, well, it doesn't just appear. 7 years is a long time, from, and I have a, I mean, I could go on and on for hours, and I won't do it. I know you don't want to hear it. But the whole thing is, if you don't do something with the Energy Facility Siting Council, you're not dealing with the biggest issue. And it's only going to get bigger because their abuse of power has grown and grown and grown, and it gets more magnified every time they write a new rule, every time they make another decision. They're beyond question, and when you write the rules, you interpret the rules, you apply the rules, you decide who gets a contested case. If there is a contested case, you hire the hearings officer. You write the final order on the hearing. You monitor whether or not anything, you know, whether or not the people are adhering to the rule, and you bill the developer who pays for all of the staff to do all the activities that you're doing. The legislature trusted this division to make good choices and to
task force that's looking into it, chaired by Senator Olson, mm-hmm. and the intent was that he was going to spend the year looking at that and come back in 19 with a proposal. So mm-hmm. that's why it's not in here.
Okay. Let me say, I hope your bill trumps the one in the House of Representatives, because that is a non-bill. When you have an advisory committee with no authority, you have nothing. So if that's all, the best they can do, that's nothing. At least you have some, you've given some power and authority to the committee that's working, that you've proposed. Thank you.
Thank you for coming over. All righty, Dirk Dunning. Welcome.
Good afternoon. Chair Beyer, Vice Chair Thompson, and members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to talk today. I'm Dirk Denning. I'm a 25-year veteran of the Oregon Department of Energy, now retired. I was a registered professional engineer with the department and expert in dozens of fields of engineering and science. I recommend a yes vote on Senate Bill 1519, though I do have some minor qualms. The Department of Energy was a world leader in technology and policy on all energy matters for the first quarter century of its existence. That ended pretty much a decade ago with the departure of most of the agency's manager and senior technical and policy staff. The chaos that followed largely caused the debacle in the energy loan programs, and almost nothing today remains of that level of the department's expertise. The staff that's there is quite good. They're young, and they're green. That doesn't mean there's anything wrong. It's just they're young. The agency desperately needs visionary leadership and to be rebuilt from the ground up. The catastrophic effects of climate change in the coming decades will wreak havoc on our state and the world. The proposed commission should include a focus on climate change impacts because we're not ready. ODO should play a vital role in that. With rapid technological change, there will be mistakes. These must be identified and resolved as quickly as possible. The LED lighting that's now showing up everywhere is an example of this. The intense blue light the LEDs produce causes serious immediate harm to up to about 10% of our population, including to all infants, to people with eye diseases, to sensitive populations, and people with cancer, and I'm one such victim. As a 25-year veteran of the agency, I was probably going to be there for another 5 years. We moved into the 550 building, and within hours of doing that, I and two other staff had to seek immediate medical help because of the lights. In my case, I suffered two rounds of insult where the light triggered my body to attack my eyes and caused inflammatory changes in the eyes that required cortisone treatment for a total of about 12 weeks. I ended up wearing a baseball cap and glasses that block all blue light, and even that wasn't enough. Because the lights, in addition to the blue light, also turn on and off 120 times a second. And for some of us, it's a small number, but for some of us, that 120 times a second interacts in our brain to cause intense ringing in the ears and jaw pain. Anyway, the state lost my expert services because the department's leadership was unable and unwilling to respond to these harms in any meaningful way. I did go under Americans with Disability Act. They did put me out in a conference room without the overhead lights and using external light for a time. But just simply entering and leaving the building and attending meetings off-site up at Hanford was enough to destroy me. And it finally was the point that I was continuously with ringing in my ears, which I still am most of the time now, and I couldn't do it anymore. I had to leave. I recommend as expeditiously as possible, this will be next year, you will not be able to get to it this year, that the legislature should entertain a measure to declare the entire current generation of LED lighting to be inherently dangerous and to require the immediate removal of all such lighting from service within the state of Oregon. Currently under federal law, for climate change reasons, there is an energy efficiency standard beginning in 2007 that requires all the fluorescent and incandescent lights to be replaced with LED. For energy savings. As it turned out, that hasn't really worked for energy savings, but worse than that, because of the harms that are occurring to people, my expectation is that within the decade, this will be generally recognized and all of this generation of lights will have to be thrown away. All of the energy that went into making them then is lost, and so they will have caused more energy use, not less. The legislation before you should be modified to direct that the new board and ODO be required to actively assess the harms of technologies field in Oregon, not less than annually, and to make recommendations for changes in standards, both in laws to the legislature and also to the governor. In my written comments, I also included a couple of potential suggested changes in language that might accomplish that for this, so I won't read those specific changes. But the general idea is that for the LED lighting, the department, in response to my issues, agreed to passively monitor for any reports on health effects and such. They're doing nothing active about understanding what's happening. Currently, there are two other employees in the department who had, as I say, had to seek medical attention and are wearing blue blocking glasses and suffering. There's another dozen that have gone to wearing similar glasses on their own, as well as baseball caps and hiding from the light. They're hurting. And to date, nothing's being done for them. As this spreads through other agencies, I think the state should fully expect they're going to lose a lot of talented people because they simply can't work under the lights and can't live under them. anyway, thank you for your attention, and
thank
I'm
you.
Open
never
to
heard
any
of
questions
that issue
you might
before.
Have.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you.
All righty, let's see here. Ricky.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee. My
Welcome.
Name is Ricky Seguin. Thank you. I work as the policy director with Renewable Northwest. We're a regional renewable energy advocacy organization, and our members consist of renewable energy developers, consumer advocates, and environmental nonprofits. And I've submitted written comments. We are here today respectfully in opposition of Senate Bill 1519-1. I recognize we're talking about the bill specifically here, but the amendment is what I'm speaking to. Is that appropriate?
Absolutely.
Okay. That's what I'm talking about right now, dash one. I do want to thank you, Chair Beyer, and also Senator Olson, for your continuous work to improve the Department of Energy and figure out how the agency can be strong and supported well into the energy future. In the informational meeting last week, I outlined some high-level comments about what we look for when we review legislation altering the Department of Energy. And key to that was a diverse, forward-looking advisory body, and second, a responsible and robust funding source. And those are the sources of our main concerns with the bill and the amendment today. First, in regards to the commission, we fear that the makeup does not fully represent the energy industry and energy economy, lacking representatives from the renewable energy and energy efficiency sectors. In regards to the funding, the cap on the ESA, we fear, is overly limiting and would prohibit the agency from actively participating in meaningful programs and policy initiatives moving forward. I also wanted to highlight the statewide energy plan referenced in the legislation. And in regards to this, that type of plan would impact agencies and work well beyond the Department of Energy. And we would ask that the development of the plan include robust stakeholder involvement. And much like we discussed during the last session, given the link between energy and climate change, have that be specifically called out in what the plan is considering. So, again, I have written comments on OLIS. I appreciate the opportunity to provide comment, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And let's see. Then we have the three consumer-owned utilities. So why don't you all three come up together, Danelle, Ted, and Jennifer. Welcome.
Good afternoon.
I'm starting.
Go ahead.
Chair Beyer and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Danelle Romaine, here today representing the Oregon People's Utility Districts Association. And I'll keep my testimony brief. Just wanted to say thank you to you and Senator Olson for your work on this issue. As you know, we've been working on the issue of the Department of Energy and right-sizing the department and where the ESA should be in that conversation for about 10 years now. We appreciate your work on this topic. We are willing to work with anyone to resolve some of the outstanding issues here. And just wanted to say thanks for putting forward the dash one. We're in full support.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Ted Case. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Rural Electric Cooperative Association. I represent 18 electric co-ops in the state, about 500,000 people in some of the most rural and remote parts of the state. I'll associate the remarks of Ms. Romaine. For the past few years for us, the issues with the Department of Energy have been around value proposition and cost containment. The energy supplier assessment has continued to escalate 50-75%. Sometimes higher, with my members asking, what are we getting for those dollars? And we're working on that with Director Benner, and we're really excited for her and working with her to try to find the nexus between consumer and utilities and the department. So we're working on that, but we think this legislation sends a very strong signal on the cost containment part. So Chair Beyer, thank you for your leadership. We thank Senator Olson for his leadership as well. We support the Dash Ones and look forward to working with you. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairman Beyer and members of the committee. I'm Jennifer Jolly with the Oregon Municipal Electric Utilities, representing 11 municipally owned and operated utilities in the state. I'm here to testify in support of the Dash 1 Amendment to 1519, and we appreciate the efforts of Senator Beyer and Senator Olson to look at reforms at the Oregon Department of Energy and think this bill is moving in the right direction. As you may know, OMEU has also had longstanding objections to increasing the ESA purely for administrative functions and supports reducing the statutory cap. We appreciate the efforts to develop a bipartisan compromise, and we hope that this will address the growth of the ESA. Without a mechanism for lowering the ESA, we would be concerned about creating a new commission and collecting more ESA to run it. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you. Any questions? Guess not.
Thank you, Mr.
Thank you very much. That's all I had signed up to testify on this one. Is there anyone else who would like to testify? Seeing none, I will close the public hearing, and we will carry this over until...
Did you want to adopt the amendment, sir?
No, we'll do it on Wednesday.
Okay. That's what I came back for.
That's within the rules still, right?
Yep. Yep.
So we'll just do it on Wednesday.
Over.
Yep. So did I close the hearing? I did. So we're done with that one. So we will open... Where's my agenda? We'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1564.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we first heard Senate Bill 1564 last Monday again, February 5th. At this time, the fiscal impact has been issued. It is on OLIS. We do not have a revenue impact statement on that yet. We do have the Dash 2 amendment, which was also available on OLIS at that time. It made a few changes to the annual sales that were allowed under the tasting room permit in the base bill, as well as sunsetted provisions of that bill January 2nd, 2022.
All righty. I did open it, didn't I?
Yes.
I did. All right. So I have two people who have signed up, Michael Shelberg and Jason Greenwood. Gentlemen, come on down. I think I seen you both the other night.
Indeed.
It was an
Indeed.
Excellent event.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, thank you for hearing what I consider to be the most important piece of legislation.
I need you to put your name on the record.
Oh, sorry. First time giving testimony. My name is Michael Selberg. I'm the owner, founder, and head distiller of Cannon Beach Distillery, representing myself and my distillery at this time. Thank you again for putting this legislation forward. Is it all right if I use a prop?
Sure.
About a bottle of whiskey.
That's a small one.
Yeah, it's a small bottle of whiskey. That's part of the point. This bottle of whiskey was manufactured entirely by us. We purchased the grains. We ground those grains. We fermented that. We distilled it. We matured it. We bottled it. We labeled it. And this whiskey was sold entirely out of our tasting room. It took about 3 years for this whiskey to mature. We only got about 230 bottles of this whiskey, and we only sold about 120 of them. We sell that bottle for $60, a pretty steep price for a small bottle of whiskey. We sold out of that whiskey of what we were willing to sell in the first 45 minutes of release. We had lines around the street. Those 120 bottles, let's see, produced $7,200. Get back to my page here. In total revenue, and per bottle, based on how the laws are currently written, $20.22 of every bottle sale went to the state of Oregon. That's over $2,500 for 45 minutes of sales after 3 years of work. Last year, we sold 571 total cases of spirits out of our tasting room. That accounts for about 76% of our total bottle sales in the state of Oregon. The rest being out of OLCC retail outlets. We ended up paying the state of Oregon over $105,000 based on our tasting room sales alone. That accounts for over 25% of our gross receipts for the year. That's over double what we pay in total payroll per year. It is a tremendous amount of money to our distillery. I employ three people. Two of us do all the production, two people do sales. I started out from nothing. I had a very small investment. I started out in 1,100 square feet. I used every dime of money I had, took out loans, got family to help to get started. Every dollar I produced went back into the business to grow our batch sizes, and I only could sell out of my tasting room. I did not have the revenue to produce batches large enough to get into OLCC distribution, so we were entirely dependent on revenue from tasting room sales. To this day, 6 years later, we've paid over $400,000 to the state of Oregon. That money could have been used to hire more employees. That money would go towards buying grains from Oregon manufacturers. We are currently fermenting 1,400 pounds of barley grown out in Madras. We buy local, we spend local, and that money is being taken out of the local economy. It's not just us, it's all sorts of distilleries around the state. And I realize that we are a very unique distillery in this aspect, but if you read my written testimony, the amount of revenue we've produced for the state of Oregon is the equivalent to the revenue produced by the largest breweries in the state. There's only three breweries that produce more revenue than us from our tasting room sales alone. That's a tremendous statement to me, because those are national brands that employ dozens and dozens and dozens of people. We desperately need this. We are not turning a profit. We've won best craft rum in the United States in 2014 at the American Distilling Institute. We've won 20 medals on our spirits. I'm constantly trying to lower costs, but it just does not make sense that we are paying this much money for a product that we manufacture entirely ourselves, sell entirely ourselves. I can't implore you more to help us with this. I realize that money will come out of the Oregon General Fund, but it's such a small amount in comparison to the over 500 million biennium that is produced by the distilled spirits industry. And if you look at what happened with the small winery exemption, that absolutely boosted an entire industry, and it led to great revenue for the state of Oregon. The same thing can happen here with a very minimal investment, with a tax exemption. In the same way, for small producers, you could invigorate an entire industry and give people like us a chance. I'll always do this. I absolutely love the process of what we do, but it's not profitable. We try. We work. You know, I stir every mash with my own hands. We produce this stuff, and to produce $105,000 of revenue per year for the state just seems unreasonable for 571 cases.
Do you sell any out of state?
Last year we sold 7 cases out of state.
7 cases. Okay.
Yeah.
Through how?
Online distribution. But the markup is so much that it's really inaccessible. It's mostly for high-end retail shops, mostly in California.
And is that through a wholesaler or direct?
No, it's through a wholesaler, distribution company. California is kind of a quasi-four-tier system, so it goes through a lot of hands before it gets to the final retail location.
Yeah. Questions? Let's go ahead.
Hi. For the record, my name is Jason Greenwood, and I'm owner of and distiller for Divine Distillers. It's here in Salem, Oregon. Chairman Byers and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity and to provide testimony here in favor of 1564. I'm not going to be as eloquent as my friend. We're in the process of opening a small craft distillery here in Salem, and as part of our business model, we are sourcing all our fruit, all our raw materials from local farmers here in the Willamette Valley. We're trying to produce a local farm-to-glass experience where everyone will be able to experience the flavors of Oregon all the way through from the fruit all the way to the final distilled product. And we've already agreed, and we've already set this up as part of our business plan, that a portion of every dollar that we make will get reinvested in our local economy. And as we grow, hopefully, that investment will continue to grow. There are approximately 70 distilleries in the state of Oregon, and of those 70 distilleries, the average is $65,000 in sales in their tasting rooms. Of this money that we get, which is approximately $4.5 million for the state, 80% of that revenue comes from the top 15 tasting rooms. That means that most of that revenue will still stay with the state of Oregon with a cap of $250,000. If we allow this cap of $250,000 for small distilleries, it will really only help the small distiller. It will give a small boost to the large distiller because they will be able to keep that first $250,000. But for the most part, what we're doing is helping small distilleries compete with the big distilleries. We cannot place our product in OLCC stores. I won't be able to produce sufficient quantities to get onto the stores. I'll be able to sell it through my tasting room. I'll be able to sell it and get local bars in Salem to buy it through OLCC, but I won't be able to place it in stores. Opening a tasting room means jobs for Oregonians, advertising money for Brand Oregon, investment in Oregon infrastructure, additional tourism money, and money invested in local communities. Every time we have a tasting room in Oregon, it means that I, as a local small distiller, welcome large distilling companies, large companies like Bacardi or Jack Daniels, to come to Oregon and open up a distilling room and take advantage, a tasting room, and take advantage of the $250,000 benefit, because that would mean more jobs in Oregon. That would mean more people coming to Oregon to do distilling tasting tours. When you sell a product at a tasting room, it saves the state the distribution cost because they do not have to spend the money to get those bottles to the end customer. It saves the state the storage cost of that bottle in the state warehouses. There's an opportunity cost of the storage of that bottle that would be taken up by space that could be taken up for another bottle. So every dollar that we actually make, every bottle that we sell in our tasting room, actually makes Oregon more money than it would if it was sold through the OLCC. This cap of $250,000 also ensures that OLCC will still get a revenue that will help them pay for regulations and other small items that they take without producing an unnecessary burden for the small distiller. The passage of this bill will help everyone in Oregon. Most distilleries that have tasting rooms lose money on their tasting rooms right now. As my colleague over here alluded to, that his revenue is greatly hurt by this. I don't expect to get anywhere near his income through my tasting room, but if I did, because I'm not in Cannon Beach, so I won't have the traffic. The passage of this bill will give small distillery like mine a reason to spend money in Oregon, a reason to invest in our local economy, and a reason to advertise for the brand Oregon. Divine Distillers welcomes any other company to come into Oregon and open up a tasting room. I want to emphasize that the vast majority of tasting room sales are first-time buyers. If we promote the distilling tasting room with this legislation, every new sale creates a potential Brand Oregon customer for life. which will mean more sales and more revenue for the state of Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions?
Is it possible to just say one more thing?
Go ahead.
Sorry. Just in reference to this $250,000 cap, if you've read my written testimony, I have just a small issue with that. It really does not benefit to sell a higher price point product in the state of Oregon with these caps. You can sell an $8 bottle of vodka that will sell many, 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 many more standard drinks under that $250,000 cap than a $60 bottle of whiskey. So we, in turn, sell less, but we still hit that cap at the same time. So I would really, really implore you to think about the concept of taxing the alcohol rather than taxing the price point. That would even the playing field. If distilled spirits are such a harm, and more harmful considering beer and wine, then why aren't we taxing the actual concentration of the alcohol rather than the price?
Good point.
Why does my bottle create $20 worth of revenue while an $8 bottle that has twice the amount of alcohol on it produce two?
Well, this is a hard discussion that I have discovered.
Yeah.
Here. It's an interesting one. I think your fledgling industries are no different than other entrepreneurs in Oregon that we dump a lot of money on to try and promote them to sell a product. You're, in essence, a traded sector business, which we like to promote in other aspects, but apparently not in this one. All of you and your colleagues who are small distillers in the state are dwarfed by one large distiller that by itself produces almost two times what the rest of you produce collectively, yet they're opposed to letting you into the business. So that's difficult. You also have where I think you want to end up, and maybe you don't because you're doing a boutique thing, is in the liquor stores, have a distribution system. Oregon's distribution system really does work to the advantage of Oregon-produced products, but you got to get there. You got to build a demand, which is what we're trying to do, and it's really hard to do.
Absolutely.
I understand that completely. So, right now, it's an uphill battle that I don't think we're going to get over this time. We started out with the idea of maybe allowing you to sell a couple of bottles at your store, and it became easier to talk about the dollar amount, but that created its own objection. So it's possible. We'll continue this discussion. It's possible. One of the irritants, I think, for the liquor agents is that the legislature operates or authorizes a single, what we call a budget limitation, or what's the maximum amount that OLCC can spend in compensation. Well, that puts you in competition with the liquor agents, and there have been notably agents are angry over the years that they are not getting enough money. And some of those, frankly, in the small stores, small agents, have the same problems that you have in terms of the system. So I think we're going to spend some time looking at that issue and trying to get to there. So I really appreciate the efforts that you're making to try and produce a product that some don't like, but others obviously do because we sell a lot of liquor in this state, and we'll keep working at it. So thank you, and I wish you success.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Anything else, guys? Thank you very much. Is there anybody else who wishes to address this issue? Seeing none, I think we will carry this one over to the next one as well. And with that, is there anything else to come before the committee? I don't think so. We are close the public hearing and we'll close the meeting.